In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoint, and we continue our drumbeat coverage of the March Towards War. Again, we're delighted to be joined by our good friend Robert Fisk. He's in Beirut, Lebanon, and he's been covering this for many years, many versions. Robert Fisk, welcome back to Flashpoint.
Thank you. Hi, Dennis.
Well, I actually would like to start with you in terms of U.S. allies in the upcoming war, if in fact there is a war. And you write in your January 4 column about a story that both American and British newspapers have not covered. And to be honest, Flashpoints has not done a good job as well on the Algerian rebellion or war between the security forces and the Islamists. Could you talk first about the actual war? What has been happening there for the last 10 years?
Well, in 1992, the Algerian authorities, following on from a considerable public desire for real democracy, held a general election in two rounds, and it was quite clear after the first round that the Islamists would win the second round. And the military, effectively, through the president, cancelled the second round of elections, and there was no more real democracy as we know it. In other words, once the wrong side were going to win the election, democracy closed down. There then followed the one, I think, in terms of myself as a journalist, one of the most brutal, cruel, revolting, physically revolting wars that I've ever covered. Islamists, I put quotation marks around these words for reasons that will follow, would go into villages which were regarded as being pro-Algerian government and cut the throats of men, women, and children, particularly women and children and babies. I went to many of these villages after the attacks took place and saw the pools of blackened blood and of the beheaded children. We saw this. It was all true. It was real. As the war went on, year after year, men, women, young women especially, who were in middle-class jobs, suddenly were disappeared. And whenever I was in Algeria and inquired into their fate, it appeared that they had been taken from their homes by police or military officers. As the war continued, more and more evidence came out that the military and the government themselves were involved in the massacres. Now, that does not mean for a moment that the Muslim rebels, let's call them that, some of whom have been in Afghanistan with Osama bin Laden fighting the Russians. They had indeed. It's a fact. I confirmed it, you know, as a reporter on the street, on the ground. That does not mean that they were innocent. But over and over again, we had evidence that the government's authority, the government's soldiers, the government's policemen, were involved in mass torture, extrajudicial executions, and in some cases, massacres in villages. I ended up talking to former members of the Algerian security forces, the police and the army, in London who had sought refuge in Britain as refugees from Algeria, as members of the security forces. And indeed, recently in France, we've had a case where a former head of the security forces tried to sue an ex-Algerian army officer for producing a book, Le Sale Guerre, the Dirty War, which the French court effectively said was true. They threw the case out of court. Now, the Algerians, therefore, the Algerian government, are experts at torture, at the use of electricity on penises and vaginas. They are experts at extrajudicial executions. And now we have the State Department formally saying that there's a lot we can learn from the Algerians. Yes, indeed, there is. And when you realize how easily and how acceptably for the Algerians, the Algerian authorities execute wanted men, and you remember how the facile, I use that in the word of easy, the facile way in which the Americans used the drone to kill four alleged al-Qaeda members in Yemen. And, of course, the way in which the Israelis talk about, you know, targeted killings, quote-unquote, in Gaza and the West Bank, you can see that a culture of execution and torture is being built up under the pretext of September 11.
Is there a real move to include Algeria in the so-called war against terror?
Well, you know, it's a fact, which again was not printed in the American press, that a very senior officer in the Algerian military was invited to go, and did go, indeed did go, to NATO's Southern European headquarters in Naples. He went there. The Americans have said specifically that they would give new weapons and arms to the Algerian authorities to fight the, quote, Islamist terrorists, unquote. So, in other words, those who have been most closely linked with the most revolting human rights abuses, abuses which the Americans rightly accuse Saddam Hussein of, these people are now going to get assistance from the United States.
Now, let's focus on your part of the world, very specifically Beirut, Syria. There is discussion, there is concern that Israel gets deeper into the war. It's not only Iraq that is the target, that Syria is going to end up in the crosshairs. We've got the Israeli military, the Air Force, part of that Air Force is in Turkey now, flying reconnaissance. Could you talk about how this could flare up, how Syria might get dragged into this, what that is all about?
Well, I think that we constantly look at the world through our own perspective, through a Western perspective, an American perspective, a Christian, God spare me, I'm not sure there are many Christians left, perspective. You know, we need to look at the world not through our eyes, but through the eyes of others. What is going on here in Lebanon, where I am now? Day after day, I open the newspapers here in Lebanon and read that the Israelis believe that the Hezbollah have 8,000 long-range rockets with which they could hit Tel Aviv, Haifa, Jaffa, whatever. Now, I travel all over Lebanon regularly on every tiny side road. There's no road I can't go on and no road I will not go on here. There are some training camps for Hezbollah, certainly in Lebanon, but nothing to do with rockets and missiles, and I don't believe these missiles and rockets exist. But if you look through the website of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, you will find that, for example, Shimon Peres, who has now left the Israeli government of Ariel Sharon, but who was in it at the time as foreign minister, said that the Hezbollah had 8,000 long-range missiles to fire into Israel. If you look at statements by Ariel Sharon himself, apparently not read by the various show business people who arrive in Lebanon to give concerts, Sharon says that the center of world terror is now in Lebanon. We had two American congressmen who came to Lebanon and said that the future of world terror was not in Afghanistan or Iraq, it was here in Lebanon. This is fantasy. And this is the same fantasy, I fear, as the Americans propagate over, you know, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There may be weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There may be there. I think Saddam Hussein is a brutal, cruel, and wicked man. But what we've got to get away from, particularly in the area of Syria and Lebanon, is fantasy. Syria over and over again, and I'm not a supporter of the Syrian regime, which even under Bashar Assad is a brutal regime which locks up people who oppose the government. But the fact of the matter is, Syria does not have weapons of mass destruction. It wants back the Golan Heights, which belongs to it, which was illegally annexed by Israel after the 1967 war. Lebanon, which is under Syrian control, ruthlessly and cruelly, in my view, but not as awfully as, for example, southern Lebanon was under Israeli occupation a few years ago. Lebanon also wants its freedom, and it wants its freedom from attack over the border. Now, when you look at the situation, you can say, well, the Israelis demand and desire and have a right to freedom from attack from the Hezbollah, which means the Party of God, which is the resistance organization in Lebanon. But Lebanon also has a desire to have the right not to be attacked by Israel, for example, in the event of an Iraqi war. The real issue here is, what do the Israelis want? Do they want security or do they want land? And you can ask the same question of the Arabs. Do they want land or do they want security? I think both peoples actually want security, but their leaders don't say that. And in an odd sort of way, the fact that the leaders in the Middle East, Israeli leaders as well as Arab leaders, do not reflect what their people want is oddly the same as the way in which President Bush does not reflect in foreign policy what Americans want.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. That's Robert Fisk. He's talking to us from Beirut, Lebanon. That's where he reports from. He reports for the Independent of London. He has won many awards for his reporting on the ground. You've been coming to the United States. You've been back and forth quite a bit lately. First of all, what do you make
every
of...
Every 3.5 weeks on average, Dennis.
As much as we can get you here,
and
we want you because...
I've just gone through my 21st... consecutive random security check.
Well, speaking about total security and, say, total information, what do you make of the total information move in this country? And I understand the United States is now trying to reach into Europe to all of your files.
Well, yes, indeed. The United States, according to Le Monde, which is a newspaper I do believe, as opposed to New York Times, the United States wants to have passenger profiles from Air France. And this interests me very much, because mainly because of their frequent flyer program. I use Air France for virtually every flight I take. When I go even from here to other places in the Middle East, I go via Paris. I go via Paris to the United States, to Europe, to Canada. It's very interesting. What on earth are they going to learn from these passenger profiles? You see, what I think is that this is a form of legalized intrusion into private lives of people. I don't care if the Americans want to know, for example, because I'm flying out of Beirut, which is why I go on the special coding on the ticketing. And if I can learn the coding, be sure Al-Qaeda can. But, if I'm going to go on the special coding on the ticketing, it's because I'm flying out of Beirut. But the question is, why is it? I'm very happy to have my bags taken to pieces at American airports because I'm all for security. But, of course, it's a complete waste of time. The real question is, what is this doing to you? For example, am I being frisked and security checked because I come from Beirut? Or am I being frisked and security checked because what I say in lectures in the United States is not what the American government want people to hear? Or am I being frisked and security checked because my name is not obviously Anglo-Saxon? I don't know what Fisk is, it's not Arabic, I don't think it's Jewish, I don't know what it is. The whole issue is, where are we going? You have this wonderful thing about homeland. I hate to think of the German equivalent, which was Heimat, I think, before the Second World War. Homeland security. Are you really being checked for homeland security? Or are you not being checked because the government wants to watch you? I don't know. I don't care about it. It's not my country. If I was an American, I'd be very worried about this. When we hear that Admiral Poindexter is going to have a major role in security for the United States, and that the reason why he's going to be appointed is he was very keen on the job. I asked myself, where are you going? But this is something you should be talking about to listeners in the United States, not to Brits living in Lebanon, for God's sakes.
Well, it is very interesting that Poindexter gets a $250 million budget after selling missiles to Iran, lying to Congress, getting convicted.
I would like to know, Dennis, what does he get as a salary? Does he get money? Is he paid for this?
I assume that he is. He probably has a nice office. I'm sure he has an office in the Pentagon. We know that for a fact. You've got a column coming up, sort of the literature of pro-war, and there's this guy named Kenneth Pollack. He's got the threatening storm. Everybody's reading the threatening storm. Could you talk about this?
Well, I read it with ever-sinking heart, because I thought it was not only full of clichés, but also because, oddly enough, the threatening storm seemed to me to be a copycat version of The Gathering Storm, which was the first volume of Winston Churchill's Second World War history, as I'm sure Pollack realized. And that title, you know, the threatening storm, tells you all you need to know about the context. Just as, you know, George Bush tried to dress himself up as Churchill fighting appeasement, so Pollack twice pretends that the world is facing the same dilemma that confronted Britain and France in 1938. The Allies could have won the war in a year if they'd gone to war against Hitler then, so he claims. The fact that Britain and France, though numerically stronger in troops, were weaker in modern armaments, whereas the US today, of course, can crush Saddam's forces in a week, is not allowed to interfere with this very specious argument. Pollack denies that Saddam is Hitler, but once more Saddam is dressed in Hitler's clothes, and anyone who opposes war is, by obviously quiet extension, a Nazi sympathizer. The arguments of this book need to be deconstructed, if you will. Let me give you a few of his conclusions. The greatest advantage of an invasion of Iraq is the near certainty of its outcome. If the U.S. were to launch a full-scale war against Iraq, we can have high confidence in victory. The costs of that victory are unclear, but even the worst-case estimates are not catastrophic. These conclusions are also widely held within the U.S. military. Being rid of Saddam Hussein, he writes, the author, would be an enormous boon to U.S. foreign policy because, wait for it, it would free Washington to pursue other items on our foreign policy agenda. An invasion of Iraq, I quote, would assure the moderate Arab states that we were serious about removing him and, quote, allow us to reduce our presence in the Gulf region, especially Saudi Arabia, where our military personnel dislike the rigid regulations and inhospitable accommodations. Now, you know, let's just stand back for a moment. For a moment, these arguments are breathtakingly immoral. War, he is saying, is the right decision, not because it's morally necessary, but because we'll win. War, far from being, you know, a symbol of the total failure of the human spirit, which involves, you know, suffering and death of innocents, is a viable policy option. It would free up Washington's foreign policy agenda, presumably allowing you to invade another country, you know, where American vital interests could be discovered. An invasion would be reassuring for moderate Arabs, whoever they are, presumably our dictators whom we pay, while at the same time rescuing those poor American soldiers from those inhospitable barracks in Saudi Arabia. I mean, you know, since Mr. Pollack also advocates a sizable U.S. military presence in post-invasion Iraq, one can only imagine what kind of accommodation he thinks the U.S. will find amid the ruins of Mesopotamia. And again, we have this extraordinary phrase. He says that it's necessary to break the linkage between Iraq and the Palestinian-Israeli war. Now, this theme occurs several times in the text, and the narrative, which is in essence an Israeli one, is very simple. Deprived of the support of one of the Arab world's most powerful nations, the Palestinians will be further weakened in their struggle against Israeli occupation. Over and over again, Pollack refers to the Palestinians' quote, vicious terrorist campaign, which I don't agree with at all. I think it is vicious. I think it is terrorist. But without the slightest criticism of Israel. He talks about weekly terrorist attacks followed by Israeli responses rather than Israeli attacks followed by Palestinian responses, which, of course, is the standard Israeli version of the conflict. When Yasser Arafat appears in the text of this book, he also appears in the index. But oddly, when the Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon appears in the text, he does not appear in the index. All these issues, when I read them, when I imbibe them, if that's a right and terrible word, make me think, what are the Americans being led by? How can you believe books like this? But many Americans regard this new book by a former CIA agent as being worthy of serious discussion. I'm amazed.
And it does seem like the American press is the real cheerleader. They're willing to follow the administration anywhere. I don't know if you followed this thing about the five invisible men who came to the United States. Maybe there were four, maybe there were six.
Five, yeah.
We didn't know how many they were. I mean, the press is really has a great responsibility here, don't they?
No, irresponsibility, Dennis. Look, the point is, let's go to the five. Five suspected Muslim terrorists had, quote, infiltrated, unquote, the United States from Canada. So the networks told us. I was on this story. I was in the United States. It was CNN's lead story for hours. They were smuggled across the border into the U.S. through a native Indian reservation. They sneaked into Toronto's Pearson Airport as refugees. One was seen at the Lincoln Tunnel, another on a West Coast ferry. And then the AP, the Associated Press, suddenly discovered one of the five men calmly working in his jeweler's shop in the Pakistani city of Lahore. And then the FBI's official spokesman admitted that, quote, I quote, there's no border crossing information, i.e. Canada-US, that would say they're here. And now the FBI website has taken the pictures and the names away. But this is not just something small and erroneous. Look at all the scare stories that Britons have been fed these past few weeks. Smallpox, dirty bombs, attacks on hotels and shopping malls, a chemical attack on the tube, the metro in London, the poisoning of water supplies, postcard target attacks on Big Ben and Canary Wharf, the procurement of 5,000 body bags, 120,000 decontamination suits, survival classes for seven-year-old school children in Britain, new laws to quarantine Britons in the event of a biological attack. Please God, this would quarantine Mr. Blair in Downing Street. There seems no end to this government terrorism, which we Britons suffer from, let alone you in the United States. You know, I ask myself, do these governments want bin Laden to win? Or is this merely part of a countdown to war, which I suspect you think it is, on Iraq, the sort of essential drug of fear to ensure that our acquiescence exists when the time comes for the British or American governments to do something which it knows the vast majority of their people oppose?
Finally, I hope you'd have a couple more minutes. I want to come back to Israel. Israel is playing a major role here. We see a expanding collaboration with the Turkish government. This is interesting to me because here you have a government in Turkey and its predecessors responsible for the first attempted or genocide in the 20th century against the Armenians. And now you've got the Israelis working with the remnants of these Holocaust types. How can you talk about that, and what does that mean?
Well, you know, there are many Israelis, and one has to be fair about this, who believe that Israel's relationship with Turkey is seriously skewed. Israel's own most prominent and most brilliant Holocaust scholar has spoken out very bravely against the Israeli denial, the Israeli government denial, of the Armenian Holocaust and genocide. Shimon Peres, who has tried to suggest in visits to Turkey that the Holocaust of 1.5 million Armenians, Holocaust is the word we use on my newspaper with a capital H, but in no way demeaning the numerically much more terrible Holocaust of Jews in Europe under Hitler. You know, we have again and again said, how can the Israelis deny this genocide? The saddest thing is, and I go to Turkey as well as I go to Israel, is that there are very brave Turkish journalists and writers who are trying to get Turkish people to understand that the Turkish genocide of the Armenians happened. It is real, it is true. There have been television programs in which Turkish journalists have been seriously abused, grotesquely abused verbally by viewers because they have said that this genocide happened. One of the things, I mean, in the 2 minutes we have left, very briefly, on the 22nd of December, I addressed a very large Jewish organization in Nottingham in England. And I talked to them afterwards at great length about the Armenian genocide. I said, Jews must, like all the rest of us, acknowledge that this genocide happened, just as we must acknowledge that the murder of 6 million Jews in the Holocaust happened, which it did. And by and large, I think that European Jews and mostly Jewish Americans do acknowledge the Armenian genocide at the hands of the Turks. But Israeli government does not. Israelis do, but the Israeli government does not. And I think that's a terrible, terrible shame. One of the reasons why I say this is that I've done a lot of work on the Armenian genocide, because after all, it happened in the Middle East, here where I work. In many cases, the young German officers sent by the Kaiser to teach the Turkish army how to fight in the First World War were present during the genocide of the Armenians. And in many cases, the young German officers, 20 or 30, who were sergeants and captains, turn up to be colonels and generals in the Wehrmacht in the Soviet Union after the German invasion of Operation Barbarossa in 1941, as being responsible for the Jewish Holocaust in the Soviet Union. So here we have a case of clear connection between the Armenian Holocaust and the Jewish Holocaust. And yet over and over again, even in the modern day Middle East, Israeli officials will not acknowledge that connection, which they must do historically and should do historically. And to their great credit, Israeli historians do acknowledge, and many Israelis acknowledge. I couldn't write so powerfully. I couldn't write with such self-assurance about what happened to the Armenians were it not for the help and assistance of Israeli as well as Armenian historians. But Israel as a state continues effectively to deny this genocide. They deny this Holocaust for political reasons. And the fact that the United States itself won't accept that this Holocaust of the Armenians happened at the hands of Turkish, Muslim, Ottoman oppressors is a great shame, and I use that word shame in every sense of the word.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. Robert Fisk, you are in Beirut, Lebanon. You report for the Independent of London. And as always, it has been very enlightening.
Well, thank you very much for calling me.